Hi, all. If you listen to our season 14 finale, you know that our very own Leah is gearing up to welcome her sweet baby girl into the world very, very soon. On account of that, we are taking a small break from our regular episodes, and in the meantime, we'll be delivering a handful of Hasty History episodes. If you are not familiar with Hasty Histories, these are bonus episodes that we are calling No Nonsense, Crash Course, Cram Session, History Lessons. So there will be no cocktail segment, no ads, and no bloopers. This is just a quick download of some heavy history content. If you enjoy longer podcast episodes with lots of back and forth conversation over unique cocktails, we recommend checking out our regular hashtag history episodes, which drop weekly during our regular seasons on our regular feed. But as for now, let's get to this week's topic. Today, by very popular demand, we will be discussing the Great Molasses Flood. Oftentimes, events in history are given obscure or vague names, but that was not the case here. The Great Molasses Flood was quite literally a flood of molasses that swept through Boston, Massachusetts in January of 1919. And while a flood of sticky molasses may sound amusing, this incident would turn tragic, with 150 people injured and another 21 dead. Professor and civil engineer Mark Rosso put it perfectly when he said of the incident, quote, "First, you kind of laugh at it, then you read about it, and it was horrible," unquote. So let's get into it. It was January 15th, 1919, in Boston, Massachusetts. At roughly 12:30 p.m. or 12:40 p.m., dependent upon your source, residents of the area heard what History.com described as a metallic roar. Although residents truly did not have enough time to process what had made the noise before tragedy would strike, it wasn't particularly unusual for residents along Commercial Street in Boston's North End to hear random metallic creaks and crackles from time to time. The source of these metallic sounds was a 50-foot steel holding tank located on Commercial Street that contained millions, yes, millions of gallons of molasses. The tank itself, owned by the United States Industrial Alcohol Company, was haphazard at best. It had been constructed in a rush in 1915 during the First World War, and it wasn't unusual for molasses to leak out of it from time to time. In fact, residents of the area were so familiar with the regular molasses leaks that it was common practice to bring their own cups from home to the tank to fill them with free molasses. But the events of January 15th, 1919 were far worse than a few little leaks. The holding tank would burst, sending 2.3 million gallons of molasses through the streets of Boston's North End at a speed of up to 35 miles per hour. As we all know, molasses is a thick, liquidy substance. Think of a flood of water. Molasses has 40% more density than that. When this thick, dense liquid flooded the streets, it would quite literally take down buildings, animals, and, of course, people. Author Stephen Poilo, who wrote about the Great Molasses Flood in his 2004 book titled Dark Tide, The Great Boston Molasses Flood of 1919, was quoted as saying, quote, "Molasses, waist deep, covered the street and swirled and bubbled about the wreckage. Here and there struggled a form, whether it was animal or human being was impossible to tell. Only an upheaval, a thrashing about in the sticky mass, showed where any life was. Horses died like so many flies on sticky flypaper. The more they struggled, the deeper in the mess they were ensnared. Human beings, men and women, suffered likewise," unquote. This was no laughing matter. Given that this event occurred in January and the weather was roughly 40 degrees Fahrenheit, this meant that the molasses didn't have the opportunity to heat up and flow out evenly. Rather, it pooled up in the two blocks that it spread, essentially thickening, and trapped humans and livestock alike. Aerospace engineer Nicole Sharp, who has heavily studied the molasses flood, has speculated that rescue attempts would have been much easier had this event occurred in, say, July, when the heat would have allowed the molasses to spread out further and more quickly, allowing it to thin. But this just wasn't the case here. Rescue efforts would ultimately take 4 days to complete, as those that went in to help found themselves quite literally stuck in the same problem as those they sought to assist. It would take months to determine the number of casualties. Some had been so maimed by the molasses that they could not be recognized. Others wouldn't be found until months later when their bodies washed back to the shore of the Boston Harbor. It's really horrific if you allow yourself to think about it for too long. What's possibly more horrific is that this event was entirely preventable. An investigation was conducted and found that the person responsible for the construction of the tank couldn't even read blueprints. Huh? This now makes sense as to why there were severe, fundamental, structural issues with the construction of the tank. In fact, there is speculation that the tank was already leaking from the very first day that it was used in 1915. It is speculated, with good reason, that the tank was built very quickly in 1915 to, one, supply alcohol, which could be distilled from molasses into weapons for war efforts, and or, two, to try to get ahead of the ball before Prohibition was put into effect just a few short years later. In addition to the joke of a construction job that this tank was, it was also later found that the walls of the tank were entirely too thin to carry the weight of 2.5 million gallons of liquid. Although the tank had been filled a total of 29 times over the years, only 4 of those times had been to complete capacity. One of those times was, of course, just days before the horrendous molasses flood. It was also found during the investigation that the proper testing on the tank had never been conducted. Listen, I'm new to tank construction and testing, but in very little research, I found that it is customary for a tank to be tested with water first before being filled with any other liquid. This way, you could check for leaks. But this, however, was not done in this case. And the leaks in the tank were obvious. You'll recall from earlier in the episode that locals were accustomed to taking their own personal cups to the tank and filling it with free molasses themselves. It was known that this tank leaked on a regular basis. And yet the United States Industrial Alcohol Company did nothing about it. Wait, I shouldn't say they did nothing, because they did do something, all right. In an effort to hide the massive leakage, they actually painted the tank brown. While all of these causes were known to the company, something that was not known at the time was the power of manganese. Manganese is a mineral often used in steel as a way of strengthening it. What more modern engineers have determined when studying the Great Molasses Flood is that the tank had been mixed with far too little manganese, making it weak. The steel was particularly weak on days when the weather was cool, such as the date of the molasses disaster, which would cause the metal to become brittle. In the aftermath of the tragedy, salt water was used to wash the molasses from the streets, followed by sand that was used to absorb it. Cleanup efforts would take weeks, and it was reported that even after cleaning and cleaning and cleaning, quote, everything that a Bostonian touched was sticky, unquote. In fact, rumor has it that even decades later, Bostonians could still smell the molasses in the air. The United States Industrial Alcohol Company was sued as 119 residents brought a class action lawsuit against them. The company attempted a defense argument that the tank had actually been blown up by anarchists. Tell me it's the early 1900s without telling me it's the early 1900s. But the court called bullshit on this and found them liable, ordering them to make payouts to the families of the victims for what is the equivalent of more than $11 million today. I appreciate how Professor and Civil Engineer Mark Rosso summarizes this whole incident. He states that while there was so much evidence and data to show what went wrong that fateful day in January of 1919, it isn't so much about the science behind it all as it is about the ethics. He said, quote, "Most of the things I've looked at don't really have so much to do with lack of scientific knowledge, so much as a lack of responsibility of the people in charge. It's an ethical issue rather than understanding the science," unquote. Thank you all, as always, for listening to another episode of Hasty History. I would also like to say a major, major, major thank you to my amazing husband, Alex, for editing this episode of the podcast. Like I mentioned at the beginning, we encourage you to check out some of our full-length episodes of Hashtag History, which we drop weekly during our regular seasons. If you have suggestions for more Hasty History topics, please send them our way at #history1865@gmail.com or on our website at #history-pod.com. We want to tailor these Hasty History episodes to you, so be sure to drop us a line on any topic you love or want to learn more about. Make sure also to follow us on Instagram at #history_podcast, where we post lots of extras, including behind the scenes of recordings, drink recipes, and so much more. You can also check us out online at #history-pod.com for all the sources used to put together this episode. Thank you all so much. Stay safe out there, and we'll catch you next time.